I'm Lisa DeLay, and you're listening to the Spark My Muse podcast. Welcome to Spark My Muse, everyone. Today, my guest is Ryan J. Bell, and he is the podcast host of Life After God, as well as the author of the book, A Year Without God. Thank you so much, Ryan, for being my guest today.
Thank you for having me.
I suppose we can probably begin with talking a little bit about some of your background. And I know you've gone from believing to atheism, and that's a journey that you've been public about. And maybe you can start out a little bit with what your journey has been in summary.
Sure. Yeah. And to also to be clear, I haven't finished the book. It was a blog primarily at first. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I wrote a blog called A Year Without God, which you can still find at Pathios, pathios.com. And it's just called Year Without God. And to go back into my background, I was raised Christian. My folks were Methodist, I believe. Yeah, Methodist when I was born, and pretty quickly became Seventh-day Adventist because my mom's folks were Seventh-day Adventist. And I, you know, went to church with them like, you know, kids do with their parents. Mm-hmm. And I sort of took to it. I mean, even as a young kid, I remember feeling quite spiritual or intrigued by religion. I often say that if I hadn't been raised in a religious household, I might have been a philosopher as opposed to a theologian. You know, because my mind just went in those directions, even as a youngster. So I just kind of stayed on that track. When I went to college, I majored in the humanities at first, and then I went and did like some pre-med courses thinking maybe I would be a physician. And in the end, I kind of went back to kind of a passion that I had for leadership and community and religion and the Bible. So yeah, I was a pastor in the Seventh-day Adventist Church for 19 years from, you know, 2000. No, I'm sorry. it was much before that, 94 to 2013. Mm-hmm. And I think over that period of time, I just became gradually more liberal, progressive in my views about basically everything. Mm-hmm. Politics, theology, mm-hmm. Human nature, just basically everything I could that I encountered sort of widened my view of the world and of people and of my place in the world. The landscape just kept growing and growing and growing. But my religious framework stayed the same size. Mm. And so I felt, you know, constrained by my religion as early as probably, 2001, I would say, 9/11, we just celebrated 15, celebrated's the wrong word. We just remembered 15 years of, since 9/11. And I think that was a big turning point for me when my world got quite a bit larger and I just started feeling like an ill fit with my religion.
Well, for people who don't know what Seventh-day Adventists are, or that's really quite conservative, do you celebrate, is it a celebration of, is it on Saturdays that there's worship? And what are some of the other sort of defining characteristics about that sect of Christianity?
Yeah, it's an American-born sect. It's a part of the Restorationist movement that sort of began and came to fruition in the United States in the mid-19th century. Mm. Some other similar movements, the Stone Campbell movement, the Churches of God. Okay. Churches of Christ, I mean. They are sort of a part of that offshoot from Christianity. Our founders were Methodist and Christian Connection and deists, and a variety of different backgrounds. But there was an uptick in the culture around millennialism, like just this idea that Jesus was coming soon, that we needed to be prepared. A lot of prophetic interpretation from, you know, from the prophetic books of the Bible, sort of predicting that Jesus would come soon and that we all needed to be ready and so forth. So there was a big emphasis on the soon coming of Jesus, and then the restorationist side of things. The impulse there is to go back to the Bible and find these lost truths or these forgotten truths that, you know, basically mainstream Christianity had left behind. And so Sabbath was one of those for Seventh-day Adventists.
Yeah. And it, so it was the conservative kind of constricting nature, the thing that kind of in a way squeezed you out, and you thought there has to be more, and you started digging into, I know I've heard you say you were, there were a lot of banned books, and then you started like reading that forbidden fruit, really. And would you say that because there were sort of forbidden things to read or dangerous things to read, then you wound up reading them and then wound up kind of thinking there's a lot more out there?
Yeah, I guess that's part of it. I mean, and it wasn't so much like science and philosophy even right away. It really was theology. I was really looking for different ways of understanding the Bible and Christianity that would allow me to grow within the sort of framework in which I was raised and schooled. It wasn't that I went to cosmology and sort of went out of religion like that. I sort of gradually became a much more liberal Christian, much more progressive Christian. It had to do with reading. It also had to do with people. You know, the more I encountered people and had, you know, just various relationships with them, whether as their pastor or friend or colleague, I just started, I guess I felt that the world was, like as I said before, a much more generous place than I had been led to believe. That you know, there was room in the world for Episcopalians, you know, and for you know, for I don't know, Pentecostals even, you know, and then Muslims and Jews could be okay too, you know, and then so it was, that led me into a lot of first ecumenical work at on a small scale just in my local community, and from ecumenism to interfaith dialogues and relationships, and more than just, okay, what's the lowest common denominator that we all have in common, but really, you know, intentionally learning about each other's beliefs, but even more than beliefs, there our motivations, our passions, our convictions, our ethics, you know, what is a Sikh all about, you know, like my Sikh friend who was raised evangelical, and he's, you know, he's a North American, and years ago he embraced Sikhism as his path, and it's hard for me to get my head around becoming a Sikh. I don't think that would ever be something I would have been tempted to do, but I like him, and we've traveled together, and we've explored you know, issues in our city together, and I thought, wow, if he could be a Sikh and really essentially share many of the same values that I have, what does that mean about the exclusive nature of what I've been taught? And it was just by meeting. And then, of course, you know, gay and lesbian and transgender people who my religion taught me were, you know, outside the bounds of God's grace. And even though God loved them, they really needed to rein it in before God could accept them. And that led me to a place where I was at odds with my church as well.
So by the time you get to the blog, A Year Without God, are you at this point already kind of doubting and heading towards atheism, or are you going, no, let's try an experiment? Like, so lead me up to that part of your journey.
Sure. Yeah. So in 2013, January, my conflict with the denomination came to a peak, and I had a series of one-on-one conversations with the president of my denominational region in Southern California. And it was a really heartfelt, earnest conversation. We went back and forth, me claiming that I was still a legitimate Seventh-day Adventist minister and him challenging that idea. In the end, he was really right. I really wasn't a fit anymore for that work and that group of people. So from January through March, so for 3 months, we had these conversations, maybe five or six of them over the course of 3 months, which led to my eventual resignation from ministry. in March, and I gave my last sermon at my church on the Sabbath before Easter, that we always remember as Holy Saturday, which kind of like is a remembrance of death and endings and silence and absence and all of the rest. So it was very odd timing. And so I took the next 9 months from April through the end of the year, kind of giving myself space to not worry about things except for finding a job and figuring out what I was going to do with the rest of my life. My marriage came apart during that period of time. I took some time off and went to Central America, studied Spanish just to kind of really change the scenery. And when I came back, I started again thinking about church, trying to find a place to go. And, you know, to make a long story short, the further I went down the path of, you know, well, maybe I'm not an evangelical anymore. Well, that became pretty clear. And then maybe Episcopalianism, and there were problems there for me that were similar, Catholicism. And then I thought, well, maybe I'm spiritual, but not religious, which I can't stand that, you know, like for years I sort of resisted that. The low numbers in my pews were a result of all these spiritual but not religious people, you know, who wanted to go surfing on Sabbath morning instead of come to church. And we needed them to organize, to change our community. And everybody was having their own private, isolated, you know, independent experience of wonder. So it seemed very LA to me, very American, very, you know, capitalist, you know, kind of like seeking my own, you know, personal Jesus moment kind of thing. And I was like, ugh, you know, I can't tolerate that kind of individualism. But anyway, I was like, maybe that's me now. This is a horrifying idea. And then I thought, well, where's the bottom here? Like, where, how far down does this rabbit hole go? And I started to suspect, and I had read a little Alain de Botton, you know, Religion for Atheists. And I had done, I'm sort of an amateur sort of armchair reader of philosophy and was familiar with kind of the atheist key texts. And we had done, and I'm friends with Pete Rollins, and we had done some Holy Saturday kind of atheist Christian type of services at the church. So I wasn't, you know, like blind or ignorant to atheism. And I had this kind of back in my mind suspicion that, well, maybe there's no God, but maybe that's not really the point. You know, this kind of ontological God. So I'd kind of loosely let go of this idea that, you know, God answered prayers or that God was going to show up in my life and change something. That really, if I was going to change something, I probably needed to change it myself and organize a few people together to do whatever we wanted to do. So so when I came to the end of that year and started the blog, I really was at a point where I suspected that my hunch was that there wasn't a God, there's no God. But I really kind of wanted there to be a way, I wanted a way to redeem the idea of God or to believe in God if I could, because my whole world was built around that, all of my friends, you know, all of that. So I thought, well, this is, I'll take a year, because it was like December 27th or something like that. And I was reading a book and I was having lunch with a friend and I said, you know, maybe I'll blog about this. And he's like, oh, you really should do that. So it was just very impromptu. I went home and found a URL that seemed okay and wrote a blog. And I was I've been a writer off and on for Huffington Post on their blog. So I thought, well, this is probably interesting fodder for Huffington Post's religion page. No idea how, you know, how it would go. And it just blew up. And the next 3 to 4 months of my life were essentially nonstop fielding questions from all sorts of people about what I was doing.
Yeah, but there's been such a breakdown of institutional religion, at least in the United States. And I guess Christianity is sort of having a boom in the global East and the global South, in Pentecostalism anyway. But for a lot of people in this country, there's the nuns, the growth of the N-O-N-E, you know, they don't find a home in Christianity very well, and they're questioning things, or they're, not so many people are going full on atheism, but there's a lot of people where it doesn't work anymore. And so who was approaching you the most, do you think?
When I did my...
Yeah, with their questions. Yeah, when you were doing those, the time when you were being approached by so many people with questions.
Yeah, I mean, I would say it's I was probably besides journalists, it was people who were in a similar position to me. People who were who are questioning their faith, not really sure who to talk to. Because if you're in that position of really seriously doubting the veracity of not just this and that, like even not even something like the resurrection, because there are plenty of, you know, Christians who don't really believe in a bodily resurrection of Jesus, whatever, but like really the core stuff, like is there a God and is the Bible reliable and that kind of stuff. They're not, you know, typically they can't go to their pastor because, or they don't think they can because it's too scary and they're just going to try to convince the person to step back from the edge of the cliff. And you can't really maybe not go to your atheist friends because they're just going to like enthusiastically affirm your doubts and say, well, it's about time you woke up from that fairy tale. you know, so it's like, who do you talk to? Like, who do you really go to that's not just going to interpret in your question what they already believe to be true and just kind of like project that back to you or whatever. So I found a lot of people because I deliberately said for a year, I'm going to sort of hold this middle space. I think people felt comfortable in approaching me and saying, I feel like I'm in that middle space too. Nobody's talking about that middle space really as an okay place to be. I still have people who come to me. In fact, just this last week, I had a conversation with a friend of mine. We got coffee and she's like, I don't know what I am anymore. I don't even know. Like, I don't feel like I'm a Christian, but I also don't feel like I'm an atheist. I don't even know how to call myself. And my response to her was just to say, like, do you feel like you need to call yourself something? Like, who's telling you that you need to call yourself something? I mean, it's just maybe just let it ride for a minute. You know, it'll become clear. So I think that's there's people that are recruiting for all sides, you know, and to feel recruited. And then that was the other group of people. I mean, people that really wanted to recruit me to one thing or another, you know, so I had a lot of that.
Yeah. Well, it is an identity issue. If you've identified one way or the other, whether you're a doubting atheist or a doubting evangelical or whatever, you know, nobody wants to lose anybody for their team and people want to get people on their team. You know, there's proselytizing everywhere, really.
Oh, true. Yeah.
And so it's hard to relax when you're in a liminal space that is in between space or a doubting space or something, or just even in Christian circles, I suppose, or I should say maybe it's in Catholic circles, the dark night of the soul. And my graduate work is in spiritual formation, but a lot more of the Catholic tradition where there's a lot more space for dark spots where it's very obscure and you don't have to have all the answers and stuff. And in a way, there's a lot more space for that, where it's not panicky. And so you actually could go as an atheist or as an agnostic or as just super confused, you know, in betweener to a spiritual director, and they're not going to be like, and let's make a decision now.
Right.
So it depends where you're coming from, but I've noticed it is so hard to talk to people when you're in a hard spot because there's panic in the eyes of a lot of people you're going to talk to.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. And so as you've moved to this spot of atheism, you became basically a materialist. Is that right?
I would say I don't often use that word.
Okay.
Not for any reason. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I mean, I guess that's true.
And do you, for your own well-being or anything, do you hang on to any spiritual practices of any kind, or are there any vestiges of your old life at all in any kind of practice or thought or anything like that?
Yeah, I guess so. I mean, I'm a bad practitioner. I'm really not a model practitioner. So there's my aspirations and my intentions, and then there's what I actually do. So I would say that I'm a believer in a kind of non-religious or non-supernatural kind of mindfulness. I don't believe that there's any but I think that, you know, a practice of mindfulness, of paying attention to our thinking, of being aware of our tendencies to respond and simply react to stimuli, and how to become more aware of that and be able to get some separateness from our feelings and our reactions to things is super healthy. And I would say it's akin to a contemplative prayer, where we would, meditate on a word, be it love or peace or whatever it is, and as our minds wander, coming back to that word or coming back to a kind of centered place of focusing on physicality, of our bodies, where our bodies are, how we're feeling, being aware of the feelings that we're having in our body, and just acknowledging them in a non-judgmental way is a spiritual practice that I engage in, not in a very structured way, but even like yesterday, I was driving down the road and my daughter was talking to me a mile a minute about something, and I had a lot on my mind about work and about her and about my schedule for the day, and I just felt my chest tightening and my breath shortening, and like I felt like I couldn't catch my breath properly, and it felt like anxiety or panic, and I thought, well, that's interesting, like that's a feeling I'm having, doesn't mean that it's going to destroy my life today, or that it means I'm a bad person, or it doesn't mean I'm a good person. It doesn't mean anything really. It's just a feeling that I'm having, and I did choose to, have a little distance from it. And so I think that's just a really healthy way of trying to approach my presence in the world, and affects the way I try to show up.
I think there's a lot of neuroscience and empirical data behind that type of awareness and mindfulness too, that you can, whether it's a spiritual practice or just, the data behind mindfulness is all there too, whichever lens you're looking through is effective for changing how you see the world.
Right.
In terms of, this is one of the things I've wondered about, people who have kind of decided that there's no big other, I guess as Jacques Lacan and Tad DeLay was talking about in some of his work, is that there's a lot of, when you come from a Christian standpoint, now I don't know how it is if you grow up atheist, because I guess you don't have the language and all the experiences in all those suitcases that you accidentally drag along with you.
Right.
But if you have this set up already in your categories mentally of an I, thou, and you have something like, we all know that practicing gratitude is helpful no matter which tradition you come from or no tradition, right? Just being grateful for your life and your health and whatever is always going to be, put you in a better mind frame. But when you're so used to, for me and in my background, and maybe you and yours, you're great, you have gratitude, but it's usually based on an I, thou, thank you, but who are you saying thank you to? Or like, how do you, where does that go, and how do you, where's that baggage go, or have you resolved it? Or I'm just kind of like, I guess I'm just picking your brain a little bit,
yeah,
because I have no idea how that works.
Yeah. I don't know either. Cause I do still feel grateful.
Sure.
Like the other day, it cooled down so nicely. It's been so hot here in Southern California. And I know I'm really complaining to a nation full of people who have it way worse than I do in terms of the weather. But it has been oppressively hot this summer. And it cooled down the other day. There was a nice breeze. And the sun was setting in a really pretty way. And I walked outside and I was just like, wow, this is good. This is really good. I'm just so happy to be here right now. And I guess I didn't feel compelled to locate, kind of a destination for my gratitude. And I think a lot of times in this kind of modern, new agey sort of thing, people might want to say, well, you're just being grateful to the universe or whatever. And I'm like, no, I don't have a personification of the universe that way. I really don't. I think the universe doesn't give a damn about me. It doesn't care whether I live or die. In fact, it's sort of like probably closer to caring about whether I die. Like, the nature is... If you took away my apartment and my food source, my easy access food source, I would be in trouble, right? Like, nature is not on my side. You take away all the maintenance that we do, and grass starts growing through the cracks of the pavement. Like, all this stuff we put up is like crumbling. So I don't feel like the universe is sort of loves me. I don't feel like I belong here or that I deserve to be here. And I think part of my gratitude is the sense that I don't feel like I deserve to be here. I don't feel like I deserve really anything except now that I am here, I deserve to be treated fairly. And I, you know, and I think other people do too. They deserve to also have a shot at a good life and a fair shake at the good things that we need to live and survive and thrive. So I guess I just feel I feel grateful to the people in my life that also help me. I'm grateful for my friends, my kids. I'm grateful for help when mm-hmm. people step alongside me and help me with something. So yeah, that's enough for me, I think.
Yeah, people have often said, and I've heard you say, address this on your podcast, which we can get into, you starting the podcast and some of your aims and goals and the missions for it. And well, I guess maybe not mission is maybe not the word, but some of the things that you're after with doing it. And talking about how a lot of people have a criticism of atheism, like, oh, well, once you take out God, then what's your motivation for being moral? And I've heard you say on the podcast that sometimes the idea that once you remove sort of the big other or, whether that's kind of a big, angry, mean God or a Santa Claus type of God, that you have to decide sort of as a grown-up to be moral. And you have to, try to just on your own be good in the world for just the sake of goodness.
For goodness sake.
Be good for goodness sake. And, maybe you can unpack that a little bit, but also tie in why you decided to go for a podcast and what are some of your reasons for doing so.
Yeah, I think I'm a very bottom-up thinker, I would say. I guess that's one way of saying it. I feel like and I've always been this way, which I think is why I sort of gravitated toward Judaism in the latter years of my Christianity, because I felt like Judaism created a theology around a community rather than creating a community around theology.
Oh, yeah.
And I think that's a real difference between evangelicals and, say, Jews, for example, because, evangelicals, it's this objective truth, whether it's the Bible or Jesus or some combination, and then you build a community around what we commonly believe in. Jews are theologizing about what it means to be Jewish all the time, mm-hmm. and it often has to do with love, work, sex, food, the built environment, gardening. I mean, it's very earthy, right? Mm-hmm. It emerges from the bottom, and then they talk about, well, what kind of thing? What do we have to say?
Mm-hmm.
What can we say about this thing that we have this common experience of?
Mm-hmm.
And so I feel like in terms of morality, I'm fine being a moral pragmatist. I have almost no anxiety about that whatsoever, and which is different than a relativist. Like, I don't think that relativism is this idea that there's no kind of norm, and there are norms. I mean, you have to sort of deny reality to deny mm-hmm. that there are moral norms. I mean, if you walk outside and violate a few, and you'll find out that there are moral norms, and mm-hmm. I don't feel the need to ground those moral norms in the command of a big other in order for them to be useful norms, even comfortable calling them right and wrong. And because they don't redound to things that are wrong, don't redound to the thriving of human life and non-human life. So yeah, that's fine for me. As for the podcast, people had been asking me to do a podcast, and the last thing I want to do is, do a podcast just because we don't need another podcast or another book or another magazine just so that somebody has something to do. But at the same time, if there was a gap there, if there was a niche to fill or some kind of need, or not even just a need, but a valid purpose, then I was, kind of looking forward to doing something like that. And the podcast sort of grew out of the bigger picture idea of life after God. I had been asked by so many people along my year without God journey to chat people would say, do you have a minute? Could we talk on the phone? Mm-hmm. And I, in the beginning, I would say yes. And then I just got so busy, I couldn't talk to everyone. And then I thought, like, how do I get some sanity around this? And then I thought, well, maybe there's a real genuine need here that we could recruit others to help fill. And so the idea of Life After God really was, how do we create community, both online and in person, both group and one-on-one, with resources as minimal as, hey, here's a private Facebook group, you know, knock yourselves out, to a much more structured, okay, we'll have 6 coaching conversations over the next 6 weeks about kind of where you are and where you'd like to be and your thinking and acting around your changing viewpoints. And so we do that. That's what we do. So we have a secret Facebook page. And the reason it's secret is that a lot of people aren't out about their doubts or their conclusions. You know, some people are just confused and they don't know what they think. Some people are, they've decided that they're atheists. And it's not a settled thing. They're still curious about the world, but they're at this point in their life, they're saying, no, I don't believe there's a God and I'm ready to figure out what's after, which is why it's Life After God. It's more focused on what comes next. What do we do now? Mm-hmm. How do we cope with the challenges that come along with being post-theistic, but also what do I do with my life? Like you said, like without this big other saying, this is your purpose in life, go fulfill it. This is your calling, go meet it. What do we do then? Do we sort of just become selfish, you know, hedge fund managers, or do we, you know, like what do we do with ourselves? How do we manage our parenting, our marriages, our intimate relationships, friendships, you know? So that's really the focus. And the more we get into this, the more I think the gravity moves towards productive outcomes as opposed to remedial types of things. And by remedial, I just mean like remediating the problems that come with losing your faith or stepping away from your faith or however you want to describe it to, okay, I feel like I've, you know, landed in a good place. Now, how do I move forward into something new and productive and creative?
Well, it's interesting because once you give up the belief system that you had been embracing, there is a community of atheists. Well, I'm speaking, of course, out of turn because I'm not in the atheist camp, but what it appears to be is that there's a community of sort of revolt for the thing that they've refused or rejected, but that's not a community that like sings songs together and has festivals and you know, a common life necessarily, but that seems to be changing in some ways. But it does seem like that group still needs to serve some of those common core needs of community. Because people still have those common needs of wanting to gather, but right. Not only to be in rejection of something else. Do you know what I'm saying?
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think a lot of atheists go on to be humanists, which is kind of a secular moral philosophy grounded in, I mean, it's a limited term. I mean, the terms are always somewhat limited. Mm-hmm. I mean, to me, the limitation of the term humanist is that every humanist I know cares about much more than just humans and humanity. We're also interested in the rest of the planet and what, you know, we humans are doing to it often. So it's not just about humans, but it is about like thriving, flourishing, supporting the flourishing and thriving of life and building community and meeting the psychosocial needs that people have. Mm. In a way that doesn't make reference to supernatural or mythological notions. Now, I mean, I say without, I think people can refer to myths all the time and do without necessarily ascribing to them a sort of corresponding sort of scientific reality. But yeah, without reference to those types of superstitions or supernatural beliefs.
Yeah. And so some of the things you're doing, maybe you can dig into a little bit more of some of the things you provide. I also appreciated, I had Jennifer Michael Hecht on my program as well. I know you had Jennifer on
your. And she's one of my favorites.
She's really interesting about how she talks. Well, first of all, I really appreciate her secular argument against suicide, and I think it's extremely important whether from any perspective that you're coming from, because it's just based in facts, and it's really insightful. It's just. I just really appreciate that. So we've kind of teamed up in a few, you know, on the Twitter universe, and I want to have her back on when she is finished with her next book. So I just really love Jennifer. But what's great about her is she's kind of pinpointed that atheists, of course, she's a staunch atheist. Atheists will sometimes be in this place where they've like someone who's broken up with a bad boyfriend, as right. she puts it. And so that's kind of the emotional part right then. And then once that breakup part's over, then you can kind of get on with things. And she's like, if people created morality, I'm very impressed, you know, so that's how she puts it. But one of the things that I really love about her is kind of a full embrace of the humanities, of the arts, and that sometimes these things that evoke wonder and evoke things that are, I guess you could say, not data driven or not totally empirical, is something she embraces because there's, I guess you could say, awe and mystery to them. And that she actually winds up getting a lot of flack in the atheist community for that sometimes. But I see that as you've had her on, kind of, maybe you can talk about a little bit about what you spoke about with her
in your show. Let's have a little love fest here.
Yay, Jennifer.
Hey, Jennifer. Thanks for being awesome. So I love her expression, poetic atheism, and I think it stands somewhat opposed to a very sort of rigid, what I like to call Vulcan atheism, this kind of logic-focused approach to the world, which as a Christian, especially as an evangelical, I really lacked a lot of training in logical, rational thinking. And so I've benefited greatly by being in the atheist community and really their staunch insistence on data-driven, evidence-based, rational thinking. And I agree that making important decisions in your life based off of ideas or beliefs that don't have any basis in evidence is probably not a very great way to live over the long haul. I really have benefited by that perspective. On the other hand, we aren't, Vulcans. We aren't as rational as we like to think that we are. Mm-hmm. And I think we become slightly more dangerous in the world when we don't acknowledge our own non-rationality, our tendency to be non-rational. And not even just a tendency, but it's a part and parcel of our being human, that this is part of our human existence, is to have emotions, to reason from intuition, to appreciate beauty, and to allow beauty to shape our decisions even at times. We do it all the time. And I find, in my experience, that the louder that a person claims to be rational and logical, the more they're kind of pushing back against something underneath, which is, this kind of gets back into Tad's work, it's a kind of repression, I think, of something that they're resisting or fighting or trying to deny, which is that we are deeply emotional beings as well. And I think that Jennifer does such a nice job of holding these things in tension. I mean, her book, Doubt, which is to me like an aspiration for a life work, you know, like, and she's done it so early in her career and gone on to do other great things. I just pulled it out the other day to look something up, and a friend of mine's listening to the audiobook. I just can never say enough good about it. It's such a great resource on this history that very few people have actually investigated or written about. Very, very academic, but accessible book. You know, whereas some of her, you know, she writes also poetry, you know, and has published volumes of poetry. And this is Jennifer. And this is not just Jennifer. This is all of us, actually. We all have this rational side, which says, you know, I need to go to work on time, even though I feel like crap, because I know that if I don't do that, other bad consequences can follow. So I'm just going to do it anyway, no matter how I feel. You know, other times, you know, we might say, I'm just going to linger here a bit longer because I'm just really in a space where that my and again here and now here I'm going to use the word soul needs this, you know, this fresh air, this view, this relationship, this coffee, really conversation with a friend. I'm going to you know, carve out the space for this, even though maybe rationally I should probably wrap it up and move on or whatever. Mm-hmm. I don't know if that's a very good example. I just pulled that off the top of my head. But I think it's that kind of reasoning that, you know, Aeon had a great, the blog Aeon, I don't know how to properly pronounce it. It's A-E-O-N. Mm-hmm. They had an article recently about soul, you know, in quotes, and kind of what it is and how we share it in common with animals in some cases. Mm-hmm. And it's this sort of emotional seat in our brains that, you know, cries out for attention and acknowledgement. And I think that is a healthy acknowledgement in all of our lives.
Mm. Yeah. And I think sometimes when we're in a liminal space or confusing space, or even in a space of rejecting beliefs, that we'll be really frightened to use what has been religious language like soul or spirit. And I've told people before that when I say spiritual, I'm often talking about just aliveness.
Yeah.
And that it doesn't have to be like completely poisoned words, you know, that we could talk about soul as being sort of the seat of awareness and emotion. That it doesn't always have to mean that you can say it only relating to the Bible or to church or something like that. You can kind of take the words to mean things that are larger, and that we don't have to run away from them screaming, because it's hard. English is hard, but language is hard because there are things that are just beyond words, and that is part of the human experience too. And as Jennifer writes the new book, I guess it's Wonder Paradox, at least that's the working title for now, she's going to explore a lot of things about art and mystery and awe, and I'm really looking forward to it. So she's kind of a she's definitely one of my favorites, because she embraces so many different sides of being human without the same sorts of fears that other people do. I think that it's like, oh, I can't explore that because that's out of my territory, and I can't explore that because that's out of my territory. But there's a bravery.
And I think people like her give permission for others to do it. You know, like if I'm like, oh, here's a person that I respect who's really highly rational and an atheist like me, who also has this real deep appreciation and language that she's put around awe and wonder and beauty and art and all the rest. And I think that's super important. We need that. Mm.
And so what else can you say about your podcast and what you're up to and what you're hoping for as you move on with it?
Yeah, we're, you know, one of the things that's been most exciting lately, as what you referred to a moment ago, is we call the X-Files. They're just stories of just individuals, people you've never heard of, most likely, who are X something. Whether and I'm open to really almost anything, like people who are ex fundamentalists who are now sort of mainstream Christians, even, you know, how does that go? Because there are a lot of people like that. I mean, a lot. And so these stories just help people feel, number one, not alone, and number two, not crazy, because they have these connections to others that have similar experiences. And I think we're just, again, back to this kind of humanities bit, like we are storytelling creatures, you know, we look for patterns and we like to see our story reflected in someone else's. That's just part of what it means to have our brains wired the way they've been wired over the last millions of years, that we're pattern seeking storytelling creatures. And then we resonate with it. And it gives us energy. I just, you know, the other day I was really having a rough morning and some really bad news. And I just sat down and finished the novel I was reading. Mm-hmm. And by the end of it, the story that I was reading, it wasn't some, you know, huge profound insight or anything, but, you know, it was somehow a person who overcame odds to go on to have a meaningful life, even if it wasn't completely perfect. And I thought, okay, I'm ready to do the rest of my day. And it was almost like reminded me a little bit of like morning devotions, except I was reading a novel, you know, totally made up story. Talk about fictions. Something about that story resonated with my heart and my experience. And I was like, okay, I'm part of this too. We can do this, you know? And isolation is just really dangerous for people. I don't think that isolation is the way we're meant to thrive. Now, I don't think that means you need to go to church every week or go to Sunday assembly every month or go to Oasis every month or every week, or you need to go to some structured quasi-religious. None of that is required in my mind, but we do need one another in some form or fashion. And I think that, you know, post-religious, post-theistic communities, as well as progressive religious communities of various types, really have an exciting next decade or two ahead of us, you know, because folks like Greta Vosper, who have been deeply embedded inside of a very traditional but very progressive religious community, now finding themselves on sort of on the outside of that, having been, you know, sort of rejected by those communities, you know, it begs the question, you know, where does this all go? And we're starting to see secular expressions of church, if you will, pop up. I mentioned Sunday Assembly and Oasis are two sizable examples, but there's also a host of one-off meetups around the country. And they're all different kinds. You know, sometimes they're just, you know, people that get together to clean the highway and they happen to be skeptics. That's what they share in common. Or maybe they are a very heady group and it's like a skeptic society of San Antonio or something. And they get together to listen to lectures and they invite guest speakers to come and give a lecture about science or about philosophy or whatever. And that's what they do. That's fine. There's no like right or wrong way to do this. But I think if we look into it, whether we're just going to the local pub to have a beer or whether we're meeting up with a friend for coffee, we do need to be in these relationships with one another that both challenge us but also comfort us in some way.
Yeah, the places where we can be authentic and not have to pretend. I mean, we can wind up pretending in just about any group.
Of course.
We need people who are kind of, I don't know, give us a hug and kick us in the pants at the same time kick our butt in gear sometimes too. But, and that's kind of why, no matter what trajectory religious communities are on in general in the United States or around the world, I think people will always assemble, always kind of try to figure something out because we are tribal creatures, it seems. This has been really fun. I really hope that you can come back on again in the next few months and we could chat again about something else. Maybe it will be topical or something like that, but it's really fun to speak with you.
Lisa, I wanted to say too that I love what you're doing with your show, and I will definitely do everything I can to let people know about it. I think it's what to me marks the kind of people I'm most interested in spending time with, whether virtually or in person. People like Jennifer, people like yourself, people like Tad and Mike McCargway that I just had on. I think it's the word I keep coming back to is curiosity. You know, people that are curious about everything. They're curious, and some of us are going to specialize in one thing or another, right? Because we don't have enough brain space and time to be curious, to actively be curious about everything. So some people will be more curious about science, and other people will be more curious about psychology and the mind, and other people will be more curious about the humanities or whatever it might be. But to say that, you know, people that are genuinely curious, and that's what I get out of your show, is that you want to talk to people, not so that you can have a podcast, but so that you can just have the joy of interacting with people that you can learn from or be inspired by or inspire others by. So I think that, you know, to me, the thing that blows my mind the most is when I encounter someone who they strike me as completely incurious. They're completely satisfied with their understanding of the world as it is. And I'm just like, I don't have any point of reference for that.
Like, I'm done learning. I can die now.
Right. I'm like, I don't get that at all. I really, truly don't get it.
Yeah. Well,
that's my advice to people too. Like, okay, if you want to be a Christian, that's fine. Be curious about it. Be curious about your world. Don't hesitate to ask any question that you feel like asking.
Right. Well, the thing is, when you ask questions, this is what I've found, and it can be scary. If you ask questions, you might get answers that surprise you, which will take you in a different path. And I think that's why some people know that that's what's going to happen. And so they will try to tamp down your questions and they won't answer them or they'll deflect them. And I realized at an early age that I was getting treated a little like, I'm always been a curious person. I was homeschooled until seventh grade, and you're allowed to explore whatever you want, you know, whether you, once you finish your work, right? And right. I noticed that I started asking questions that was not okay to do that in certain settings. And I thought, I wonder what's so dangerous about this. That just made me more curious.
Right.
Exactly. Yeah. And I think it's usually power systems that have something to lose, you know, that are the ones that are most concerned about people asking questions. And I'm highly suspicious of that. And I think we all ought to be, whether it's religious or anything else. Like, I think that tendency to try to quash people's curiosity and natural wonder and admiration for the world and interest in it, I think that's the dangerous thing. And religion does it in spades, but other types of groups, like political groups, for example, and, you know, publishing houses that, you know, want to sell, but anybody that's trying to sell something. And I'm a salesperson. So, like, I think that it's a caution to all of us.
Mm. So where can my listeners find your podcast and find the things that you're doing?
Yeah, there's a one-stop shop, really. It's lifeaftergod.org. All the episodes are linked up there. And you can find them. And we have all of our social media links, except maybe our Instagram, which we just launched. So all of our other social media is linked there. We have a very active Facebook page. My partner, Brian Peck, curates our social media, and he's really, really good at it. And he creates these great memes that are really shareable and thought-provoking. We've just started doing a new thing, which I'm really excited about, on using Instagram, and which it also shares to Facebook, called My Life After God. And these are just short stories, sort of like Instagram journalism, which a couple of journalists are starting to do. But these are first person narratives, usually 200 words, maybe at the most, of a person's life after God. And it could just be a little small, you know, insight window into their life. We're trying to just break down the stigma for a lot of people that if you don't believe in God, that you're some kind of a monster. And, you know, so they're beautiful, and it usually includes a picture of the person. You may not be able to make them out, identify them from the picture, depending on the wishes of the person that's telling the story. Sometimes we use pseudonyms for people that aren't publicly out about their non-belief. But it's just some little window into someone's life that just humanizes the experience of doubt. And I think they're just really, really beautiful. It's giving a voice to as many people as care to share.
Yeah, I also want to point out, too, that you're very generous on the show. For Christians who are listening to my program now, it doesn't mean that if you listen to Life After God that you're, like, turning to atheism, or that you're that you're going to be suddenly outed as an atheist, like, accidentally or something like that. It just there's a broad – you've had all kinds of people on your show, so it's not like – only atheists can listen to this show. You know, it's not like that, but it's definitely a safe space if that's the place that you find yourself. But it's also for all kinds of people, because I wouldn't put myself in the atheist camp, but I love your show. And I love the, but I'm also not frightened of, see, that's the other thing, is that I came from such a fundamentalist background as a child with my parents. Everything was scary. And I realized, like, calm the heck down. Like, you don't have to be scared of every single thing. Just right. Relax. And so I'm not actually scared of atheists. That's why I have them on my show. And so that's the other thing. If you don't feel like you have to freak out, definitely Life After God is not a scary place. But I appreciate the generosity of your show, because it is just a welcoming place. It's not like and we hate all believers. It's not like that kind of a atmosphere or anything like that at all.
No. And it's, I've had Christians on the show. I heard via social media that one of the biggest the pastors of one of the biggest mega churches in the country recommended the podcast to a group of Christian leaders at a conference. Mm. And, you know, these are like middle America evangelicals, you know, so, and he said, look, you guys need to hear these stories. And so, yeah, whether you're listening to it for like clues about why people lose their faith or whether you're just curious about the human experience, and what might cause a person to lose their faith, I think it is, there's a lot of insight there.
So yeah, you provide some valuable things, right? And I appreciate your work and what you're doing.
Thanks so much. I appreciate that.
Show notes for this episode can be found at sparkmymuse.com. There you'll find details for websites and people and books mentioned in this episode, and sometimes you'll find photos and videos too. Please stop by and check it out.